Well, the 1st of October is China's National Day. And this year it has a particular significance because this year, the 1st of October marks the 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. On the 1st of October 1949, Chairman Mao stood up on the gate of Tiananmen Square, Tiananmen Gate, and announced that the Chinese people had stood up. In other words, declaring that China was now under a new regime. And in the beginning, after the founding of the People's Republic, there used to be these kind of parades almost every year, following on the Russian, sort of the Soviet model. But then after the Cultural Revolution, these parades kind of stopped being staged every year, except in 1984, which was the 35th anniversary. They had a major parade where Deng Xiaoping took the salute. And this year, of course, it's the 60th anniversary, so it is particularly significant. And it comes about a year after China hosted the Beijing Olympics. And therefore, you know, there is an added significance that China has demonstrated to the rest of the world that China is an important country. China has achieved remarkable success in its economic development and modernization. And therefore, this anniversary is particularly significant. The last 60 years of China's history really can be neatly divided into two parts. The first 30 years were the period of Maoist economic and social policies. And the second, or the last 30 years, since 1979, has been a period of openness, market economy, economic modernization, engagement with the rest of the world. The first 30 years were quite eventful, because during the first 30 years, after the founding of the People's Republic, China carried out a series of radical political campaigns. So first we had in the late 1950s, we had the Great Leap Forward. The Great Leap Forward was a tumultuous sort of event in China's history, led to very serious social and economic consequences. Some scholars argue that up to 30 million people may have died in the wake of the Great Leap Forward as a result of the policies of the Great Leap. Then in the 60s, we had the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution started in 1966 and officially ended in 1976 with the death of Mao Zedong. And Cultural Revolution, too, was a very tumultuous event. It also led to large-scale dislocation for a lot of people. A lot of people suffered. A lot of young people missed out on education and professional development opportunities. But then the latter 30-year period, the last 30 years, has been very remarkable in the sense that China has maintained a constant engagement with the rest of the world. China has kind of maintained a focus on developing a market-oriented economy. And it's a result of the last 30 years' economic policies that Deng Xiaoping initiated in late 1978, early 79, that China has really become such an important economic power today. And it doesn't mean that the last 30 years haven't seen major tumultuous events. 1989, the Tiananmen Square clearly came 10 years after the open-door policy started. And Tiananmen Square, of course, had a major impact on how Chinese people saw themselves and how the rest of the world saw China. But one of the remarkable sort of policies that China pursued after the Tiananmen Square, contrary to what a lot of people believe China might do, a lot of scholars were saying in 1989 that China will now turn inwards. But instead, Deng Xiaoping then argued that rather than turning inwards, China should continue to open up its economy and continue to engage with the rest of the world. And we have seen that over the last 20 years, since 1989, the Chinese economy has grown several folds. And China today is a much stronger economic power than it was in 1989. So that particular emphasis on maintaining a market-oriented approach to economic development has meant that China has continued to grow, continued to improve living standards of Chinese people. But on the political front, if you look at the last 30 years, on the political front, we have not seen a major shift in systemic terms. In other words, The Chinese Communist Party controlled very tightly China's political system in 1979, and it continues to do so even today. It doesn't mean that there has been no change in terms of personal freedoms. In terms of personal freedoms, Chinese people today have much greater personal freedoms, both in terms of, you know, freedom of movement, travel, jobs, educational opportunities, starting a private business. So there has been a change there. But in terms of sharing power, the Communist Party has not tolerated any opposition parties, for example, or independent trade unions. So in that sense, the central control of the Chinese Communist Party on the political system remains intact. We haven't seen any softening of that. I think China has a lot of internal problems. Externally, I think China's standing in the international system has grown tremendously. China today clearly is an important player. There is no solution to any of our global problems without China's involvement in this. And that is partly why now foreign powers, whether it's the United States or European Union or Australia, feel that they really have very little influence on China. The only way to deal with China is to engage China, to talk to China, to try and draw China into the international institutions, and what Americans call to make China a responsible stakeholder in the international system. But domestically, China faces many challenges. The Chinese government faces problems not only in Xinjiang and Tibet, I mean, as you refer to the uprisings in Tibet and Xinjiang, but also in other parts of China. There are problems, for example, with unemployment in the urban areas. There is a large number of people, millions of people, in fact, who have lost jobs as a result of China's, you know, market-oriented economic reform policies. People who used to work, who had stable jobs, lifetime employment in state-owned enterprises, many of them have lost jobs as a result of the focus on market economy, profit, and economic efficiency. In the rural areas, too, there's a great deal of disquiet, because the rural population in China feels that they have not benefited as much from the economic reforms of the past 30 years as the people in the cities. Plus, we've also seen excesses carried out by officials at the local level. So, for example, although in the late 1970s and early 80s, the Chinese government handed the land back to the Chinese peasants under the household responsibility system, but we've seen many complaints over the last 20 years or so from Chinese farmers, Chinese peasants, who complain that local officials have been confiscating their land for development purposes or for even private purposes. So there is a great deal of corruption in China, both at the national level and at the local level. So there is a combination of grievances from both rural and urban people in China, which, in my view, pose a serious threat to the stability of the regime. And the regime has been focused very much on trying to solve those problems. So, for example, if you look at the focus of economic policy after the economic reforms began in the late 70s, the focus of economic reforms was, until 2003, very much on economic growth. That growth is essential if China is going to lift people out of poverty. But what that did was that created a large middle class in China, and also a fairly sizable number of people who are quite wealthy in China. If you look at the Gini coefficient, which is an indicator that is used to measure economic inequality in a country, China today has a Gini coefficient of 0.43, which is higher than India, which is considered to be a very unequal society. China's Gini coefficient is almost equal to Nepal's. So you can see that in terms of inequality, China today has a serious problem with that, even though the country is ruled by a Communist Party. But there is a tremendous imbalance in the distribution of wealth in China, and that has been a cause for concern for the Chinese Communist Party. And that's why, since 2003, the current leadership of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao have focused very much on creating a social security system in China, creating health insurance, medical insurance for the poor people, because they know that unless they can deal with these problems, the stability of the regime will be called into question. The future of China from here on is clearly the biggest question that everybody wants to, you know, get an answer to. And there is no clear answer to that question. I mean, some people argue that China will, you know, become democratic in the next 15 years as China's, you know, economy continues to develop, as China's per capita income continues to develop. A large middle class in China will become a force for change, as happened in Taiwan, as happened in South Korea, that the emergence of a sizable middle class will lead to a democratic change. I think that particular hypothesis is a bit too optimistic, because I don't think the middle class in China is the same as the middle class in Taiwan or South Korea. The middle class in China is very much a part of the political establishment. Many of the rich people in China, many of the entrepreneurs in China, many of the senior executives of Chinese companies are members of the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party has deliberately, particularly since the beginning of the century, has deliberately tried to co-opt potential oppositional forces, you know, within the party. And that's why I don't see the middle class in China as, you know, as a force for change per se. But if the change were to begin from within the Chinese Communist Party, which is a possibility, that once you have a more enlightened leader, a leader who believes that this dichotomy between a market-oriented economy and a very tightly controlled political system cannot continue forever. So once you have a leader with that vision, a vision for change, the charisma for change, I think we could see beginnings of political reform from within the Chinese Communist Party. And if that were to happen, I think these middle classes who are now very closely connected with the Chinese Communist Party will see the benefits of having a more liberal, you know, political system, a system where there's rule of law, where, you know, local officials cannot arbitrarily confiscate land or property, for example. They will see the merit of, you know, that kind of political system. So I think when China does change, it'll be not just because of you know, the middle class, it'll be because of a combination of both changes initiated by enlightened leaders within the Chinese Communist Party and the need for change as felt at the societal level, you know, the people in general feeling a change in the political system will benefit them.